So welcome to this concluding session on loving all of our neighbors, disparities and justice in this unique time we're living through. We are so grateful to have had really a whole month of very distinguished speakers. We're grateful for all of the people who have made time to come and join us. And we're especially grateful today to have the distinguished writer, Tony Norman from the Post-Gazette, who is out there every day putting together thoughts and words for us to consider. And we're here have been looking forward all month, really, to have Tony come and really kind of put flourish here at the end on this excellent series. I won't say anything more other than to say that if you have friends who couldn't make it to this, of course, the audio and video recordings will be available within a couple days on the Westminster website. If you found this through Facebook, you can find the link to that there on the chat. And as soon as it's up, I'll probably put a notice up there. But generally, that's up by Tuesday. Thank you so much, Tony, for being here and for coming out in this weather. I know driving in the snow is not one of your most favorite things to do, but here we are. Thank you so much, and over to you.
Thanks, Ted. It's good to be here. It's good to be here with you, and good to be back at Westminster. This feels like, this is actually, I think, probably we're coming up to a year since I've actually stepped into an actual church. So it's good to be here with good friends at their invitation. The name of my talk here is Let's Try Systemic Justice for Once. Even before the murder of George Floyd gave birth to an unprecedented number of protests across the country and around the world, we all knew what systemic racism looked like. Even before Black Lives Matter generated a clarion call of conscience that resonated with millions of Americans who were formerly content to sit on the sidelines, pretending they were merely innocent bystanders, we understood the meaning of structural inequality on an intuitive level. We could see it in the unequal distribution of goods and services distributed to our fellow citizens by a government that refused to be an honest broker or enforce standards of justice for all through the majority of our history as a nation. We could see it in the contempt of those that willingly countenance a century of Jim Crow segregation and racial terrorism after 246 years of slavery. We all know people who refer to this period of profound moral stagnation as the good old days. They want to return to a time when more genteel forms of white supremacy, interspersed with occasional pogroms and lynchings, kept America great. It was a time before the Bible got kicked out of the public schools, a time before racial minorities got uppity, and a time before women saw themselves as equal to men. It was the golden age of Christian civilization in America. We were truly a city on a hill, albeit one with plenty of blood on the doorknobs and no trespassing signs on freshly slave-mowed lawns. In the sentimental retelling of that period, Jesus himself inspired the founding fathers to write a constitution that embraced the rights of white landowners at the expense of everyone else. Apparently, Jesus lost all of his peaceful ambition once he turned white, abandoned righteousness, and became America's God. After baptizing as much systemic injustice as possible, he shacked up with a perfectly nice Jezebel named capitalism and proceeded to create a new religion more suited to the amoral complexities of the times. Blessed are the rich. Everyone else has to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. The kingdom is theirs if they're willing to work for it. Blessed are those who mourn for the nation's lost greatness, for they will be comforted by Gog and Magog, nationalism and xenophobia. Blessed are those who are proud of America. They know their value and understand that they are entitled to the whole enchilada. They will either inherit the earth or take it by force. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice to be done to somebody else. Be merciful to those who deserve it and unmerciful to those who don't. God blesses those who are pure of heart, but makes allowances for those who need to be graded on a blood-slick curve. For they, as usual, will cut to the front of the line to see God first. Blessed are the war makers, for they shall be given discounts on all the latest weaponry. Blessed are the prosecutors, because somebody's got to fill these prisons with poor people. Blessed are the mockers, because they will be given space on social media to amplify my values. Do not cry when they are deplatformed, spat upon, and cast out into the wilderness. If they abide in me, they'll arise from the darkness once again. Just ask my buddy Satan. You get the point. The liberating spirit of Christ, that is the antithesis of injustice, was turned on its head to rationalize systemic injustice over four centuries. Despite the ridiculous notion that we have ever been a Christian nation, our brutal history bears witness to this simple truth. Our current economic and political system represents the flowering of the seeds of exclusion, exploitation, inequality, and systemic injustice planted centuries ago. Before we can even begin the hard work of systemic justice, America has to recognize that it was not born in the bosom of some liberty-loving Eden. We are a country that has its deepest roots in hell. Consequently, as a nation, we have never pursued a coherent set of policies designed to facilitate justice, fairness, and equity of opportunity for all Americans. Every institution is fatally contaminated at the root. Even the church, despite admirable pockets of resistance to the evil of inequality, has bowed to this narrative. Sometimes this co-option takes absurd forms. We were all revolted by the ubiquity of Christian crosses and Jesus flags at the siege of the Capitol on January 6th. Large swaths of American evangelical and charismatic movements have bought into a Christian nationalism that is only one sinner's prayer removed from American Nazism. As previous speakers in this series have laid out, there's a reason why there are so many racially disparate outcomes in healthcare, education, criminal justice, and family wealth. There are reasons why systemic injustice is the rule and not the exception in America, despite our propaganda to the contrary. We are a structurally unjust nation. The Old Testament prophets, the writer of the book of Revelation, and even Bob Marley used the same term for such a place, Babylon. We have to wake up to this reality and stop believing in the myth of American innocence. For us, while handing off the burden of original sin to every other nation. Even when we close our eyes, we can hear screams reverberating down history's haunted corridors that led to the slave ships. When we open our eyes, we can see palm prints, blood and feces smeared on the walls. There's no point in looking around for someone to blame when your own trembling hands are slick with blood. We know intuitively, even while refusing to think about it, that genocide was inflicted on the people who occupied this vast and beautiful land for millennia before the European settlers arrived. The people who were here had to be removed so that an economic system based on land acquisition and the transformation of natural resources into profit could take root. It was a system that was assumed to have the blessings of God. So any amount of violence and exploitation used to implement this vision in the New World was fine as far as the popes and princes of Europe were concerned. After all, it's not like the native peoples who would be decimated in the name of territorial expansion had laws, traditions or notions of liberty the corrupt monarchies of Europe were obliged to respect. They were godless heathens whom the Lord had obviously singled out for conquest. As far as the Christians of Europe were concerned, the technologically inferior people who initially greeted them with friendship and curiosity were the moral equivalent of the Canaanites, the Hittites, and the Amorites that the Israelites happily decimated in the 40-year war for the Promised Land. Because they weren't Christian, referring to the people scattered across this new continent as savages gave metaphysical and theological justification to the centuries of slaughter and dehumanization that followed. It was not possible for the Christians of that era to accommodate the notion that the people they were in the process of displacing from the land or the enslaved Africans pressed into 2.5 centuries of brutal and uncompensated servitude had souls, much less any of the rights naturally accorded to them. These people are not made in the image of God, the Christians told themselves. They are beasts, and beasts have no rights, and subhumans have no souls. That's the original sin of this nation. We're doomed to constantly confirm this twisted birthright unless we make a conscious effort to become circuit breakers of oppression and eager architects of systemic justice. We all know what systemic racism and structural inequality looks like. As a society, we've lived with the contradictions between our democratic aspirations and our anti-democratic practices since before the founding of the Republic. Martin Luther King Jr., the most quoted and most misunderstood of American icons, made a link between racial discrimination and economic oppression. He also tied the structural racism and economic oppression to the injustice of the Vietnam War. Simply connecting the dots of racial attitudes, structural inequality, and war contributed to the conventional wisdom that made Martin Luther King the most unpopular man in America by the time he was assassinated in April 1968. Because MLK is most often viewed through a gauzy haze of sentimentality, it is difficult for those who were alive at the time to remember how much his critique infuriated just about everybody. He was even denounced by other civil rights leaders for the un-American tenor of his criticism. He was the Black Lives Matter of his time. Folks who celebrate him now with hypocritical advice to young BLM activists to be more like Martin and less like Malcolm have conveniently forgotten his proposal for a Marshall Plan-like effort to build, to rebuild and revitalize urban and rural America. Just as the United States rebuilt Europe in the aftermath of World War II, MLK was demanding that the same resources be poured into urban Black America, Appalachia, Native American communities, and invested in the health and safety of migrant farm workers. King demanded that hundreds of millions, perhaps a billion, be spent every year for at least a decade to underwrite a massive intervention by the federal government that was far more bullish about the role of job creation, education, housing reform, affirmative action, criminal justice reform, and healthcare than anything anyone of his stature and influence had ever proposed before. He was determined to force whoever the Democratic candidate for president was in 1968 to declare support for his plan. He wanted a candidate to agree publicly to work with Congress to underwrite housing, business opportunities, employment, enhance healthcare, and improve educational options in Black, brown, and poor white communities. It would be a Herculean task by any president. And he called on the church to lead by example and vowed to lead a poor people's march to Washington, similar to his march in 63 when he made his famous I Have a Dream speech. This time, MLK wouldn't be bringing a dream. He was hoping to lead a multiracial coalition with poor whites, anti-war activists, and students prominently featured this time, and what he hoped would be a tangible threat to both the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates. He knew that 1968 would also be the first year in American history in which Blacks in all regions of the country, including the Deep South, could vote for the first time without submitting to a humiliating poll tax. Finally, America had become a multiracial democracy for the first time in its history. Only South Africa and Rhodesia continued to deny Blacks access to the ballot box. 52 years later, we're still trying to get to the promised land MLK pointed to in his last sermon before his assassination. And when you think about it, it really wasn't that long ago. It was within the lifetime of most people watching this. I was born into an apartheid state. So that isn't something I can gloss over with stupid nostrums like God bless America. That's why I was so encouraged when President Biden signed executive orders last week, increasing racial equity. We're in a battle for the soul of this nation, and the truth is our soul will be troubled as long as systemic racism is allowed to exist, Mr. Biden said. I'm not promising that we can end it tomorrow, but I promise you that we're going to make strides to end systemic racism, and every branch of the White House and federal government will be a part of that. During his inaugural speech, Joe Biden singled out the scourge of both white supremacy and systemic racism, something none of his Democratic predecessors, including Barack Obama, had ever done. It was a particularly gutsy speech at a time when half of the nation had voted for his opponent in another 4 years, like the term we had just emerged from. And of course, what Biden has proposed so far doesn't go nearly far enough, but he is the first person in our lifetime to acknowledge that what we have now is injustice, and that it will require more than ad hoc patchwork to repair. He has surrounded himself with a cabinet that will be dedicated to making justice an animating principle during their White House stint. Biden is calling for something I've been calling systemic justice. Systemic justice is both attitudinal and programmatic. It requires dramatic paradigm shifts at every level of society, government, and interpersonal relations. For instance, systemic justice would dictate that First Nation communities have state-of-the-art healthcare and a first-rate education system populated with the caliber of teachers that would be the envy of parents gaming the system to get their kids in exclusive clubs, exclusive schools in Manhattan and Brooklyn. Because Native Americans have been screwed over royally, justice demands that their traditionally overlooked communities with its high poverty rates, alcoholism, and drug addiction be allocated all of the resources they need to reverse the descent into endless despair and extinction. Casino money alone won't do that, especially with so many American partners and investors standing in line to get their piece of the action. Much of their culture was obliterated and their population decimated so that we could occupy the land and profit from the resources. It was theft and genocide on such a grand level that it provided a blueprint for similar crimes in Central and South America. Instead of being defensive about it, the implementation of systemic justice would begin with one question. How are we going to help make your communities whole after hundreds of years of barbaric treatment? How can we be a blessing to you instead of a curse? In making a shift to this kind of thinking, we have to acknowledge that it is going to cost us, all of us. Why? Because we're all the beneficiaries of crimes and misdemeanors committed on a scale that is simply unimaginable. In fact, it could be argued that our entire nation is the remnant of a crime scene of epic proportions. And we all know that racism, greed, religious intolerance, and even science normalize massive theft, war, destruction of whole peoples. Until we can honestly acknowledge that simple fact, our politics will remain distorted and the resentment against our Native American brethren will only grow because of unresolved guilt. And our conscience knows what's going on, even if we prefer to suffer from self-imposed amnesia. This sounds like good old-fashioned guilt manipulation and socialism, some of you may be thinking. And to that, all I can say is, get thee behind me, Satan. American Christianity grew out of the mindset I described at the beginning of this talk. It has never been a consistent ally of the downtrodden and the dispossessed. We all know by the ubiquity of our segregated churches and workplaces. This was a conscious choice to disobey Jesus' word and example, because granting humanity and fellowship to non-Europeans would have interfered with profits and forced the beloved community to actually be the beloved community. And institutionally speaking, the Christian church in America has been a loyal ally to those in power, especially those who have promised to protect its interests and champion its causes. And I believe this flight from the sort of systemic justice Jesus modeled is the reason why so much of the American church is both an apartheid wilderness and a feckless, irrelevant force for societal change reform. And the acts of many individual congregations shine in this sea of conformity, of course, but I'm talking about the general drift of things in a year of COVID and Black Lives Matter. Yes, there are more book groups in church assigning anti-racism literature and meeting over Zoom to discuss these ideas more than ever before. This is arguably the best upside to the pandemic. Congregations are becoming more thoughtful and intentional about justice because they know what has been practiced in this country for centuries is not justice. But there will always be a remnant of those who feel the demonic tug of Christian nationalism, despite the clear and declarative admonitions of Jesus to love one's neighbor. If you look at the world through the prism of American exceptionalism, then the church is doing everything right when it scrupulously ignores the challenges of diversity, egalitarianism, liberalism, women's equality, LGBTQ rights, showing mercy to immigrants, criminal justice reform, capital punishment, expressing skepticism about war, and making peace with the other. Some of my favorite passages in scripture revolve around Jesus modeling some culturally shocking way of relating to those who were consistently the have-nots of his time. Jesus was into systemic justice long before there was any consensus on truth or justice. In fact, Jesus kept using the other to make his points about the primacy of love and justice, even at the expense of his own people. Look no further than the parable who tells about the Good Samaritan, a foreigner who stopped to help a Jewish victim of a robbery, even though his own people, including religious leaders, left him by the side of the road to die. The Samaritan spent his own money to see to the man's injuries and pay for his lodging until he was well. Or look at Jesus' interaction with the Samaritan woman at the well. Jesus enjoyed the back and forth with her, even though treating a woman who was not a relative with respect, usually given to men in a patriarchal society, was considered beyond scandalous. His disciples were so shocked by his behavior that they were reduced to silence. Jesus really rubbed it in about how superior the Samaritans were to his own people when he healed a group of 10 lepers, but only one of them, a Samaritan, bothered to actually return and thank him for the opportunity to take his place in society again. "What?" Jesus said, feigning incredulity. "Didn't I heal 10 men? So why is it that only one, the Samaritan, has come back to thank me?" I'm sure Jesus' love for the Samaritans got on everyone's nerves, especially when he started wearing his SLM button, Samaritan Lives Matter. It was always a needless provocation in the circles they traveled in, since Samaritans were considered barely human because of where they chose to worship. That's why it would have been a relief to the disciples when Jesus seemed to revert to cultural form in a way he initially treated a Canaanite woman who came to him to heal her demon-possessed daughter. The Canaanites were considered even more untouchable than Samaritans because they were Gentiles, as well as descendants of the people the Israelites slaughtered to enter the promised land 2,000 years earlier. You'll recall that the Canaanite woman threw herself at Jesus' feet to beg for his help in healing her demon-possessed daughter. Jesus, adopting the racial snobbery of the time, ignored her entreaties. The Canaanite mother wouldn't give up and was determined to wear him down. Finally, she succeeded in getting him to react. "Listen," Jesus snapped, "I have come to the children of Israel. It is not cool to give bread for the children to their dogs." the woman was so desperate for the life of her child to allow what she probably considered a typical blast of ethnocentric chauvinism to throw her off course. He was calling her dog and her people dogs, but that didn't matter. She was on the mission to save her child. "Look," she said in response to Jesus' bigoted statement, "even dogs have the expectation of receiving some of the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Every translation you read about this encounter emphasizes how taken aback Jesus was by the woman's answer. She not only had the temerity to talk back to him, she was a Canaanite and she was a woman. That's three very big strikes against her. Still, he commended the woman's faith and immediately retreated from his previous hard line. He told the woman that her daughter was already healed and that she could return home to tend to her. And she probably didn't stick around to kiss his feet or anything, since she had gotten everything she wanted and she didn't labor under the illusion that he wanted to have much to do with her in any case. Now, I prefer to think Jesus was imitating the prevailing prejudice of his culture against the Canaanites to make a point that even the most despised outsiders were deserving of justice and mercy. But it could be that Jesus did have cultural hangups like everyone else when it came to the Canaanites. But he also understood he had a higher duty to work through these ridiculous prejudices. Had he not been crucified shortly after that, perhaps he would have told parables with Canaanite protagonists in an attempt to humanize them even more. We can learn a lot from the biblical narratives about the need for practicing systemic justice. From Genesis to the book of Revelation, we learn that the powers and principalities resist reform because it is an affront to their sense of imperial privilege. Those in power, especially representatives and guardians of the status quo, resort to diversions by pointing to individuals or groups who are perceived as obnoxious, as more worthy of scrutiny and skepticism than they are. The system always wants to divert the crowd's revolutionary energy to an individual in isolation, the bigoted uncle, the racist grandma, the sexist coworker. No offense, but those people usually don't matter as much as banks and real estate companies that continue to informally practice redlining while also honoring racial covenants that have kept whole communities exclusively white for decades. Because the mission to enact systemic justice requires a collective response to a collective problem, it is always important to remember you can't approach this alone and expect to achieve anything. You need a community working together intentionally to bring about a targeted good that will eventually redound to everyone's good. All you have to do to understand the meaning of systemic justice is to remember this example of how one thing is connected to everything else. Let's take redlining. Redlining determines neighborhood composition and its tax base. That in turn affects the quality of the schools because zip code correlates to one's opportunities. Where you live also has implications for healthcare and whether or not you live in a food desert where only snacks and fast food are available, not healthy foods like fruit and vegetables. This also determines infant mortality rates and the community's susceptibility to infectious diseases like COVID-19. Where you live and how you look also determines how cops will treat you should they encounter you in a community during ambivalent circumstances. That's just an irrefutable fact of life that should make everyone deeply ashamed. Love thy neighbor isn't a mandate intended for individuals toiling alone. It is a blueprint for collective action for communities intent on practicing systemic justice. And let's be honest, systemic justice is gonna be a hassle. You'll occasionally end up in proximity to unruly people who don't look or think anything like you do. They have different experiences and sometimes different values, but that's okay. I'm sure much of what I've said here is gonna sound hopelessly pietistic to my non-Christian friends listening in, but that's okay too. I believe pursuing systemic justice begins outside the political sphere and is later adopted by politicians desperately searching for relevance. But all of us, regardless of creed or lack of creed, have a part to play in this great endeavor. The principled pursuit of systemic justice will free us all ultimately. And I believe the pursuit of systemic justice is becoming more evident by the day, even in the political realm, where moral courage and clear-eyed appraisal of our various dilemmas are rare. So with that, I just want to thank you for tuning in. And I guess we can go to Ted. If there are any questions or if people may be throwing tomatoes at their computer screens right now, I can deal with that too.
Well, I'll just say that in the chat, there are a number of thankful comments, including one from John Hayes, which says it's going to take something more precious than money to solve systemic racism. It's going to take will and money too. I think we're hearing a prophetic voice. So I'll encourage people to either type your questions or comments into the chat box, or feel free to unmute your microphone. I see, John, you're unmuted, and ask Tony directly. And I just want to add, thank you very much, Tony, for this. And I'll start with a question, and that is, as faithful Christians, how can we translate what we've heard today into not just words, but deeds?
Yeah, I think once we get past the notion that justice is passive, we'll have to make a point, you know, as a congregation and as individuals, obviously, to look for those opportunities to be proactively just. And there's no shortage of opportunities. You think about when you pick up the paper, even the Post-Gazette, and you read about all the injustice that's happening locally. You know, just find something that resonates with your heart. Something, you know, that maybe has to do with reform down at Allegheny County Jail, which is just a cesspool of injustice. There's no shortage of opportunities to help the people who are incarcerated and to lobby for people in power at the jail who will do justice by the prisoners there, not all of whom are guilty of the crimes they've been on jail for. I mean, that's just an example. Or once the pandemic is over with, you're going to find that that kids in the urban school systems have literally lost a year or two of development. That might be something that you as a congregation or as an individual can help address by tutoring, by trying to in a systematic way bring educational benefits to young folks who will desperately need them, because it will be no joke being 2 years behind everyone else because you didn't have internet connection, you didn't go to school because you didn't have the resources, you didn't have a laptop or whatever. There are things that churches in particular can do, can be more nimble than the government. You know, most churches in Pittsburgh don't have the problem of buying the pastor, you know, like a Learjet like you have throughout the South. I mean, there are whole denominations where pastors make tens of millions of dollars. And that is a crime. I'm sorry. If you were to believe, if you belong to a congregation that was paying your pastor, you know, after perks and everything, $20 million, that is a sin.
You said some of those make pastors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that a question we're hearing?
I heard a voice, or maybe. Maybe I'm.
I think it's just audio.
I have a question. John Hayes. I have a question.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, Tony. If you you think big, obviously, and if you could convince the 10 most successful, wealthy people in Pittsburgh to get together, 20 of them. In a room to come up with a plan to cooperate with the Biden administration in solving the Homewood housing problem. How long do you think it would take those very smart, economically and politically smart people to come up with a solution that would make sense? How long do you think it would take them?
Well, I mean, I would assume that they would have to study the problem in however much time that takes. But I mean, I don't think that it would take long. I mean, I think if they had the will and they had the cooperation of the folks in the Homewood who would see the benefits of this, the immediate benefits of this, I don't think it would take long at all. I think, you know, access to resources is probably the greatest impediment to justice in this country. And I think if something like that happened, oh my God, I mean, that's utopian. But the key would be community buy-in, and the key would be a sense of possibility that will basically come from an opportunity like that. I mean, you know, not to sound redundant, I mean, that it would just be a miracle. I mean, that would be the modern definition of a miracle.
Why do you think that hasn't happened?
I'm sorry, I missed that last part.
Yeah, why do you think that hasn't happened?
I'm sorry.
Why have we not?
I hear what you said, John.
Yeah, why do you think that we haven't done that? Is it just lack of will?
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, if you're asking me why the you know, the richest people haven't gotten together to help a downtrodden community, I just don't believe that they see it as in their interests. You know, I mean, I think that that's, you know, it's kind of a, it would be kind of an odd thing to ask wealthy folks to work against the prevailing ideology of their times. You know, they're told that greed is good. And a lot of them have bought into it and have bought into it for generations. And so until they either perceive a threat, they often don't deviate from that. I mean, if all of a sudden a generation of enlightened millionaires or billionaires were to rise up and say, hey, let's not wait for the government. Let's just get on this ourselves. That would be great. I think the whole idea behind Davos was originally something like that, but in a sense degenerated into this sort of celebrity ball. I don't think that unless they see pitchforks and torches coming down the road to the estate, there's often kind of a reluctance to get that involved.
Hey, Tony, Westminster has been involved in Homewood for the last 7 years. And we've been developing a campaign that connects billionaires and millionaires across Pittsburgh, wonderful, as well as the big corporations and the foundations, with the buy-in of the leaders of Homewood and the key residents, all around affordable housing, addressing trauma, addressing displacement. So the miracle you described is underway. And Westminster has been leading an effort for these 7 years across many churches, also a network of very wealthy folks, foundations and corporations, and affordable housing and addressing the root causes of trauma. And as you know, trauma is a root cause of much of concentrated poverty. That's what we've been working on for 7 years.
You got to send me some information. I have not heard about this effort, and that's on me. I should know about this, but if you can.
Well, it's been a silent, we've been in the silent phase of the campaign, because that's what you do when you, when you're seeking funds from wealthy folks.
Yeah.
But I'll connect with you and tell you what we're doing, get your feedback about it.
I mean, that to me is, that's the key. I mean, what you're talking about is what I'm encouraging.
Yep.
That's how you do systemic justice.
Well, and at the core of it, of course, is white folks and Black folks working together on these major problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a collaboration based on fundamental respect, love, and it's unbeatable.
It's
unbeatable. I mean, we're only here for a short time, right? You know, as people, it seems a shame to just be, content to just fatten your bank account and then just leave it for your kids. You know, there has to be a higher purpose to life than just being, a gerbil on a wheel making money. And I think that the thing that you're talking about is tremendous, because it's going to have real impact in the lives.
I gather you can send me Tony's email.
Will do. And I want to share a comment and a question from the chat. I think there's a consensus, Tony, that you've done a really brilliant job of drawing all the threads of this series together into a beautiful tapestry. And there's a desire that we perhaps post a PDF of your talk along with the thing. So if that would be fantastic. There's a lot of interest in that here on the chat. And then there's a question here. Do you agree that there's no neutral in this work? There's a lot of things about that circulate suggesting that maybe we need to be neutral. Tell me.
I don't know how you can be neutral about bringing about justice and moving away from injustice. I don't know what the question really means. I mean, neutrality is probably what got us into this mess in the first place. I mean, I'm sure that for centuries, when we were allowing slavery, let's say, there were plenty of churches that were neutral. It's like, hey, you know what? Let God figure it out. Let God sort them all out, on Judgment Day. I'm just gonna love the slaveholder, and I'm not gonna judge them. by the fact that, you know, he is oppressing people because, you know, hey, they have souls too. And, you know, God will give them a nice shack in the by and by, you know. That sort of perversion, that sort of pretense of neutrality is how we got into this system in the first place, this situation, I should say. So I think a great historian once said, you can't be neutral on a moving train. You know, you have to take a stance. I mean, you know, Jesus wasn't neutral about much of anything. I mean, he would go into the temple with a bullwhip and start chasing out the vendors and doing all sorts of outrageous stuff that did not endear him with the leaders of the time. And I think that's more of the model for Christians and non-Christians, because I think the people who are just being neutral, they're just in the way, because you got to walk around them, right? Because they're just standing there. You got to walk around them. You know, get out of the way if you can't lend a hand, for the times, they are a-changing.
Love it. Tony, there's a question here from Steve Fowler. How do you think the COVID pandemic has affected people's attitudes about economic injustice?
Oh, I think that is the secret sauce of people's softening towards Black Lives Matter. I think people have had time to read and digest things when we were going back and forth to work, we were involved in so much hustle, you know? We didn't have the time to slow down. But now, I think, when you have time to look online and you see, I don't know, a police officer leaning on someone's neck and suffocating them. In the past, you might have seen the headline, right? And said, he must have done something wrong, and not really gotten the gist of what was going on. You know, you think about it. The Trayvon Martin killing, and was it 2014? I think so. And you think about all the controversy about George Zimmerman. Oh, he had the perfect right to kill that kid who represented no threat to him, had a can of Coke, who yes, truly did resent this guy following him and maybe beat his ass when he got in his face and so forth. You think about how many people we know actually defended this vigilante who killed this young boy because he didn't recognize him, didn't know him from the neighborhood, killed him. How many people who were friends of ours who defended that because they related to the fact that a white guy or a Hispanic white guy, they related to him more than they related to this Black kid. And they were incensed that this movement called Black Lives Matter sprung out of this. They were incensed. There's nothing wrong with the criminal justice system. If you do the right thing, if you like obey cops or the random vigilante who comes into the neighborhood and says, empty your pockets, like, who are you, whatever. If you obey the authorities, everything's gonna be okay. We came from that. And in 2014, all the way up to the spring and summer of 2020 and the George Floyd, I'm sure George Foreman is like going, what is this guy talking about? The George Floyd protests. And we've come a billion miles as a people, as a nation. No one now, if you were to ask people what they think of the Trayvon Martin death now, it would be the complete opposite of what it was just a few years ago. So what do I think that the pandemic has done? It's given us a chance to reclaim our humanity. It's uncomfortable. It is literally uncomfortable. We are tired of this, of being shut-ins. But because of social media, because of we just have more time on our hands, we are just learning a little bit more about what this country is all about. And the illusions are being ripped away.
Hey, Tony.
Tom and Bobby Hartman have their microphone on. Was there a comment you were wanting to make?
I do. I have a question, I guess. Alicia Garza, who is one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, she writes that we are waiting for the second coming of Martin Luther King. And I wonder if you think that's true. I think it was a little bit of a dig at the church for not carrying their weight in this. And I want to sort of hold up Reverend William Barber as not the second coming of Martin Luther King, but a person who's really leading a movement that looks to me like it's talking about real social justice. So I guess I would ask for your comments on the church's involvement in that sort of visible way, and perhaps you have another second coming person that you'd want to hold up. Anyway, just curious to know what you think of that.
Oh, I agree with Ms. Garza. I think people are always waiting for the second coming of Martin Luther King. But the problem is that no one is stupid enough to step into that role again, because you'll just get shot. You'll get killed. And much better for social justice to be dispersed, that there not be one leader that, you know, let's say, you know, the white community can go to and say, you know, hey, what do the drums say? Hey, take this message back to your people. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. So it's much better if justice be a collective endeavor and not just something that, you know, one man or woman or whomever, you know, gets up in the morning and checks the to-do list. And it's like, okay, got to lead all the Black people today. That is untenable. And to wait for that is like, you know, waiting for Godot, you know? I mean, it's just not, it wasn't even true with Martin Luther King, because like I said, I mean, he was completely hated, you know, until that bullet took him out on April 4th, 1968, he was hated. And it was only when he was like dead and gone that people said, you know what? That really was a very fine Negro in the aggregate.
Yeah, because we were all safe then, I think, at that
right.
point.
So what do I think? I mean, I think Dr. Barber, or Reverend Barber, I should say, is probably the finest disciple of Martin Luther King working in the trenches today. His Moral Mondays, everything he does, I think, is it challenges the powers that be. The problem is that there aren't enough Reverend Barbers. I think that should, you know, he should just be unremarkable in the sense that no matter where you go in this country, there's a William Barber. If that's not the case, that's the problem. The problem is that we keep shifting responsibility, I should say, to these superstars as we perceive them. That's just not healthy for them. And it's not healthy for us, because we're offloading a collective responsibility again. It's like, you think about it. Martin Luther King's assassinated in April 68, and all of his plans, all of the things that he wanted to do, you know, the March on Washington, all that stuff, boom. You know, what became the big story? The fires, the fire next time, the riots, the destruction, the self-destruction in those communities.
Church is supposed to start now.
I'm sorry, we couldn't quite hear that.
I can't hear that.
Okay, well, we'll move on. We're getting close to 11 o'clock, and I just want to take a second to encourage everyone to take a look at the chat, because there are a lot of good comments in there that we haven't gotten to. But I also want to take this chance to thank David Paul for being such a good partner in this series, and encouraging people to join. And he offers a quote from Elie Wiesel, who says, "We must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor,
right,
never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Sometimes we must interfere when human lives are in danger, when human dignity is in jeopardy. National borders and sensitivities become irrelevant.
All right.
Whenever men and women are persecuted because of their race, religion, or political views, that place, at least at the moment, must become the center of the universe." So thank you for that, David, and thank you for all of your support of this series. We have time for one final comment. Anybody want to be the fearless final commentator? And I'll give that final to Tony.
Tony, this is Steve Fowler. On the question about becoming more aware of economic injustice, the thing that caught me in this at some point was having a dad in a nursing home and realizing that the caregivers he has are living in the kind of communities we were talking about earlier.
Yep.
In Squirrel Hill. And this is all across the country that people have become aware of. The people that are taking care of their loved ones are putting their lives at risk, just taking the bus, you know, with the COVID-19 running wild. Mm-hmm. And how can you not realize that it's an economic situation that's making their lives be put so much at risk?
Right. I think you summed it up beautifully. And believe me, the people who are ironically designated as essential workers don't feel so essential. Yeah, they know they're doing the scut work that no one else wants to do or is qualified to do and all that. And they're grateful for the paychecks and so forth. They're self-conscious enough to be aware of the irony of being called essential workers and being at the very bottom of the economic ladder. They're essential, but they're essential because we need to exploit somebody. And it's always essential to have someone who can be exploited so that you feel better. And that's how our system is unfortunately set up, that we don't impart dignity to these people. They still have to worry about bus routes being cut so that they can't get to their place of work on time because they don't have cars, because they don't make enough money to pay for the car or the insurance or whatever. And so it goes on and on and on. Everything is connected. Everything is connected. And really, until the pandemic forced us all to slow down, we really didn't think about it because it just wasn't convenient. You know, the economy was roaring, supposedly. Certainly for the people on Wall Street, it was. But, you know, who am I to complain, people were saying to themselves, until this pandemic forced us to take, basically, we had to sit down and take inventory, moral inventory of who we were. And that's, you know, that's a hard thing. But you stated it far more beautifully and less verbose than I have. So thank you.
Tony, I want to thank you for that, especially that last bit about how a virus has made us stop and realize that we're all connected. That's going to keep me thinking this week. Thank you so much. This has been an excellent way to end this series, and we are so grateful for all of the thought and time that you put into this. Thank you.
I hope your ratings don't go down.